session number 3901, reel 6.
At this point, Newman's Sinclairs were forced by the Ministry of Supply to attempt mass production. This led to enormous difficulties for them. To start with, it meant they had to bring in new labour. And again, Cine machinery is fairly precision instrument making. And the rejection rate was very high. By going into castings on the magazines, stresses and strains appeared. The film used to jam occasionally. The camera gates were no longer the precision gate that one wished for. The viewfinders, which have a parallax adjustment, were also inclined to be inaccurate, purely because there was insufficient skilled labour to produce the number of cameras required. It was a foolish move, really, to try and force them to produce hundreds of, well, they're not hundreds because they were incapable of producing hundreds of cameras, but to increase their output even from, I imagine it was probably 12 a year, they were trying to make them produce about 100 a year. It just didn't work.
Did the Army Film Unit accept a camera which was below quality?
If I remember rightly, at that particular time I used to see the tests. And we used to have double exposure tests, which would bring up any inaccuracies in the gates of the camera. And obviously, if there was any movement, they were rejected, and they would go back to Newman's to be adjusted. Often, the gates would have to be completely remade, or rather, be fitted with a new gate. I'm not terribly sure what number we got up to in Newman Sinclair's, but I doubt if Newman's produced for the army more than 50 cameras. I doubt it. I may be wrong.
Was there ever an actual shortage of cameras in
Well, there was a shortage of good cameras, yes. There were sufficient cameras, yes. There were sufficient cameras, but not sufficient good cameras. There was a lot of very second-rate equipment, very second-rate. And cameras were continually going back into the workshops for adjustment. It was purely because of the explosion in, as it were, caused by the demand.
After this first stage, when you were filming exercises and filming secret weapons, what did you do then?
They decided they needed more recruits, and the idea was to start training cameramen. And I presume there were the usual things put on company notice boards asking for volunteers for courses, and I remember sitting on a selection board. I can't remember who they all were, but I know that George Elvin was one of the members of the selection board. Myself, obviously. I don't know if it was Dave McDonald or Hugh Stewart or who. Anyway, I think the first course collected about 30 students, shall we say. There was myself, with Bill Allen, who was a sergeant, to help me. We concocted the course. We worked from Curzon Street House. We gave our lectures there. We did some of our field work on the Heath Extension.
Hampstead Heath.
And the lads on the course stayed at the Marylebone Transit Camp. That's the, you know, the Marylebone Hotel, which was the transit camp. That was their base. And they used to come from there every day and go back there every day. I've forgotten how long the course lasted, but I think it was about a month. And in the middle of the course, one gave them a test paper to just see how many, you know, were, as it were, cottoned on and thinned them out a bit, because you've got some very unlikely characters appeared. We had a little projectionist man. I think he was a Scot. He hadn't a clue, but they'd obviously needed to get rid of him from his company, so he was sent to us, I think. I think the course lasted about a month. This is a hazy memory I've got. And there was one other instructor, and I think was Jack Barker, who was a still cameraman from the Times. He'd been on the Times. I think he instructed. I think, I'm not sure. Or it might have been Captain Consoli.
At the initial interviewing stage, how did you sift people out?
I honestly can't remember. I think that if any of them had any experience of the film industry itself, we earmarked them. In fact, that must have been one of the things, because there was, I can remember there was one person who came on it, a chap called Ricky Myers, who'd been, I think he'd been an assistant director at Shepherd's Bush, I'm not sure. Anyway, now, well, at least about 10 years ago, I know he was an artist agent, so because I had dealings with him, so I would know. He'd been an assistant director, and so he was earmarked, of course. Trying to think who else who'd come on. I think perhaps one or two people had come in from film laboratories, I'm not sure. I can remember Ricky Myers, I can remember George Rotner, who I took over at a later date to help, because he was fairly aware of what filmmaking was about. How he got his experience, I don't know. He hadn't worked in the film industry, as far as I know, but he did know. He had a very good knowledge.
Did you look for other qualities apart from film experience in the candidates?
I suppose a sense of a visual presentation. I suppose that's all one would say. You had to have some visual sense. If you're going to be a cameraman, you must have a visual sense. The other things, if you haven't got a visual sense, I don't think you probably can be a cameraman. Even a still man, for that matter. Well, not a successful one. I mean, you can take snaps or... but nothing, I don't think much else. They've become very wooden.
Such qualities as military experience, independence?
I can't answer that question because I can't really remember. I wouldn't have thought military experience particularly was important. I mean, the important thing, really, the most important thing, is a sense of presentation, a visual sense, and I suppose a sense of self-survival, because it could be a dangerous game. I don't think it was particularly, but it could be a dangerous game.
Was your experience in Spain in 1938 a useful background to your career as an instructor?
I don't think so, because in Spain I really was concentrating, if you like, on the civilian population, the effect of war on the civilian population. As an instructor to train army cameramen, you know, you're teaching them how to cover the business of war, not the effects. So in that respect, I don't think it, you know, I don't think it didn't hinder me, but I don't think it helped.
Was there a difference between filming a mechanized war and filming a civil war?
Well, yes, because in Spain there was a lot of trench warfare. Of course, in World War II there wasn't. After the Dunkirk business, it wasn't trench warfare. So, at least not on the sector of the Allies. It was presumably in Russia. From what one sees, but only when they got bogged down, it was trench warfare. But it was definitely a very fluid war, so it was mobility, a mobile war.
Did the cameraman you were training have any military instruction during the course?
No, not at all. I think they were marched to Curzon Street House, but I don't think they were marched back. I think they made their own way back. I certainly didn't march them up to Hampstead Heath. We went by public transport, or they made their way there, and we met on site. No, I think we all went on public transport.
In what way then were you training them to be battle cameramen?
I think the first half of the course, one was demonstrating how you held the camera, how you moved, how the camera worked, I think we did everything as it were in mime. Then we had, as I said, we had this test paper just to see how many people really were with it. And the ones who weren't, we whittled down. And I think we told them the uses of the various lenses. You had a wide angle, which was a wide angle, 35 millimeter wide angle lens, and then you had a 50 millimeter, and you told them what that was for. And there was a 3-inch or 75 millimeter, and you told them what that was for. And if you were very lucky, you had 108, which was a 4 1/4 inch for close-ups, and you told them what that was for. And you asked them, we asked them, it was a written, we gave them questions and it was a written answers. Asking them various questions on uses of lenses and how you would, if you were given the a situation, ask them how they would cover it, purely from a mechanical instruction from previously without film. Then after we weeded them out.
About how many did you
read? I'm not sure. I don't think it was very many. I know. I was very sorry to lose my little Scotch projectionist, because he was very sweet, but he was very clueless. Hadn't a clue.
Did you do the weeding yourself?
Oh yes. I mean, it was obvious. I'm fairly sure. If there was any one or two, perhaps one might give them the benefit of the doubt. But I think the ones that were obvious, were RTU'd, And then we'd start, and we started then to each one would, I think we were fairly limited in the amount of stock that they could use. And then they started using the camera with film in. And, well, you know, we would sit in the theatre and we would then criticise the work. I don't think any of it was ever edited. I think it was just just shot and seen as rushes and then probably thrown away. And then from the final results of those, I imagine that Hugh Stewart and his... who was going to be in charge of the North African party. From those results, they chose, and they also questioned these chaps, I think. And from the work and the questions, they chose the people who were to go.
Was there a separate training for stills and cine?
No. At that particular time, the film cameraman was also expected to carry a still camera, and I think they were Super Icontas or something in those days. And the instruction, I think, was given either by, as I said, Captain Consoli or Jack Barker.
When the trainee cameramen were filming during the latter part of their course, what subjects did they film?
Each cameraman had to work on his own, and the rest of the course were used as troops, as it were, and so we did manoeuvres or, you know, attacks and things like this. And he filmed that and covered that. So we did continuous actions which he had to cover.
Did you teach them to film in stories?
We presented them with continuous action, and they had to make the story out of the continuous action. So, in other words, you would present them with, if you like, a situation which wouldn't stop. It would be a continuous situation, and they would film. You know, they would film it. So, in other words, it would be an incident which they would film.
And they would have to film it in such a way that it could be edited.
Yes. Yes. That's right.
Was there at any time when you were an instructor the notion that the cameraman should be taught to film for record purposes? In other words, not specifically with a story in mind, but just to record what the army was doing for purposes of history, as the early days.
I'm not sure. Our instructions to the cameramen were they were to fill in as much detail as possible on the dope sheet. So sometimes, I mean, you would get simply a magnificent dope sheet, but the pictures were useless. So I think this is a difficult thing. You see, and again, in all fairness, is that because of the limitations of the equipment they had, you see, very few of the cameras were equipped with anything more than a 3-inch lens. If you might be lucky, and you might have a 4.25-inch lens, which would give you a kind of a big head at 15 feet. You didn't have much of an opportunity, really, to cover things which would be of any value, I don't think, for historical purposes. Unfortunately, until there's a new Geneva Convention when the cameraman can go out in the middle and not be hit, and film both sides. I don't think there's a. I don't think this is a starter. Not really.
Did you teach them to fill in dope sheets?
They were given examples of a good dope sheet and examples of a bad dope sheet, and that's all you can do really. I don't think you can teach anybody how to write, not. They either can write in a descriptive way or they can't. But all you can say, well, this is the type of dope sheet that, you know, is of value, and this is the type that really is useless. And again, when you used to say to them, you know, don't describe a simply magnificent battle that you haven't got on film, because it's a, you know, it's a waste of wasting everybody's time.
What instructions did you give on the use of tripods?
Well, always, wherever possible, use a tripod. But there were so many occasions when it's quite impossible to use a tripod. But if possible, use a tripod, because the pictures are steady, as opposed to wobbling. It's an entirely different outlook today. I mean, the outlook today is if it wobbles, it must be good. If it's on a tripod, it must be bad. It's the reverse, but still, there we are.
But one could have steady film without using a tripod, I think.
We also had camera slings, you see. This is another thing. And this was a sling with a unipod, actually, which fitted kind of round about the navel. And you pull it down and you do get quite comparatively steady pictures. I'll agree, it is possible to film without a tripod and get steady pictures, of course it is. But not if you're doing any physical exertion, because you then start to breathe heavily and the camera goes up and down. So, you know, it's very difficult. The unipod is quite good. We had unipods which also went down onto the ground, but they're a nuisance because you've got this long rod trailing around, but the sling was easy because you could, it had a quick release, and you just pull it straight out, although the bar would be sticking down about a foot. At least you could run along with the camera, and as soon as you stop, stick it back in the unipod, or in the sling rather, camera sling, and get a comparatively steady picture.
Did the camera sling fit every type of camera that was used?
Well, yes, because it, I forgot, I think it's a quarter inch, I'm not sure, quarter inch, it's a quarter inch, so it was a width quarter inch, I think, on the basis of all the cameras we were using, so they were universal.
Had you used a tripod in Spain?
We were making a film. When we were making the films, I used a tripod. But when I was doing newsreel coverage of delegations and things like this, I wouldn't have used a tripod. Unless, of course, it was a march pass or something like this, and then, of course, you must use a tripod on those, because you have to move around quickly on those, and, as I say, if you start breathing heavily, you don't get a steady picture.
Were there many unsuitable people chosen to be cameramen in your experience?
I think this really comes down to the basic question is, what do you want the cameraman for? If you want the cameraman to present, if you like, a visual interpretation of the army's activities, no matter what they are, I think the important thing is that they should be trained as screen journalists, not which is which is what, you know, this is what is required for that. If you want them to produce film which will be used, if you like, in say like Desert Victory, of where you're having to build stuff, in other words, you're having to stage stuff, I think you then need a different type of cameraman. I think a battle cameraman should be a screen journalist, in other words, a newsreel cameraman. If you're going to make films such as Date with the Tank, True Glory, although you can use your battle cameraman's material, a tremendous amount of the tremendous amount of the film will be reenacted scenes and stage scenes with general staff and people like this. And I think it's then you then require, if you like, documentary cameramen, because they will be working with the director, they'll be working with the sound crew, they'll be part of a team, they're not independent, as a newsreel cameraman is, but of necessity.